Several years ago, one of our seminarians was scheduled to preach on a Sunday that included that famous text from 1 Corinthians, you know, that 13th chapter on love. Patient, kind, never boastful. And as they were preparing to preach, I actually did my best to try and dissuade them from preaching on that text. I attempted to dissuade them, for I found that love is one of the most challenging concepts to preach about because there is actually so little common ground of understanding. It is used and misused enough for a Washington Post columnist to recently declare this: "We have become a nation of phonies. We love everyone. We don't merely like them or respect them or hold them in some esteem. We love them. Performers on the stage shout they love us. Politicians love us. Acquaintances love us. We lack all formality, all distance. I do not want others to kiss me, which is starting to happen. I say goodbye and they pucker up. No, this is reserved for love. And by love, I mean real love, not the silly XOXO stuff that clutters the internet with false saccharine intimacy and emotion. I want to shake hands. I don't want to be hugged. I want degrees of intimacy, gradations, so I know where I stand, and so for that matter, will you." Now, I must say that I do find some sympathy here for the writer, for the same reason that I cringe when I come across an advertisement like the one that reads, "Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru." Truth be told, some of this is because we are simply failed by the English language. For the same word that we might use for our grandmother is used for our beloved, is used for a crisp, juicy BLT. And it's at times like this when it can be useful to remember that the Greek language of the first century held four uses for what we use the word love: that of storge, philia, eros, and agape. Storge had to do with familial relationships. Philia was used for family as well, and for loyalty between friends. Eros wasn't simply about sexual desire. It was also about the longing for another, the longing for the beauty within a person. Agape is defined this way: to have love for someone or something based on sincere appreciation and high regard, and secondly, to demonstrate or show one's love. One biblical scholar reminds us that in neither definition is agape primarily an emotional word, that is, having warm inner feelings towards another. Now, this kind of love is distinct, is active, and unlike other kinds of love, can be offered to, well, anyone. It's critical for us to find some definition about love, for our passage from John's Gospel today gives us little. Now, if you feel like you've heard this passage recently, you may well have, because it is part of the Gospel text for Maundy Thursday. So part of our context this morning is the foot washing that Jesus offers his disciples as an embodied act of love. But there is another frame to this command to love that is easily missed, for we haven't heard it either this morning. On both sides of this command to love is great suffering. Just preceding this passage, Judas, one of the inner circle, leaves the upper room to betray Jesus. And following this scene, Peter, the rock, denies any knowledge of his teacher and mentor. What deepens the pain in John's Gospel is that Jesus knows that he will be betrayed and denied. And still he commands to love. It's actually the reason that he uses those words, little children, as he addresses the disciples. These words aren't meant to demean or to patronize, but instead to reflect the intimacy of the moment. Jesus knows that his time with the disciples in this way is ending, that soon confusion and pain and despair will follow. This is his last chance to offer them what is most important. Have you ever been part of a deathbed conversation? When a loved one was near the end and was looking to distill a life, to convey what was most essential for those who will continue on. That's what's happening here. Facing betrayal, denial, and death, Jesus told those closest to him to love in return. But as I mentioned earlier, love can mean many things. Is this love to just those in the room? To those who follow Jesus? To everyone? Who is this one another? As I was listening for what this love of Jesus means for us at this time, in this place, an answer came this week in prayer. I encountered it actually in the long ago scheduled readings of the daily office. You see, this past week, we were praying our way through Luke's sixth chapter, the chapter that contains the so-called Sermon on the Plain of Jesus. He starts off with the blessings and the woes, and then he says, "But I say to you that listen, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless them who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you." And later he continues, "If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same." What credit indeed. Friends, it pains me to say this, but I must admit that I have had some dark thoughts this past week. As we continue to absorb the suffering, the communal pain, and the fear that has convulsed Boston in these past 2 weeks, the wounds of terror have been opened yet again. Like all acts of terror, regardless of motivation, these acts have served to inflict pain, to destabilize, and to sow fear. It is hard to grasp how the actions of these two young men could have wrought such terror, and yet they have. And once again, we have been forced to endure the sight and the sound of the destruction of people, young and old, who were simply standing or running by. And we've waited with breath held for some answers amidst the wreckage. Answers are still outstanding, but it seems as if those responsible for the bombings have been apprehended. And as the search for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev came to an end last week, after he was apprehended, it was then that my dark thoughts surfaced. I wished him dead. This is not to excuse, but I am obviously not alone. The emergency workers who treated him in the ER at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston have been searching themselves after treating him to keep him alive. And a movement to seek the death penalty in federal court is underfoot as I speak. Now, I tell you, friends, I can grasp what it means to love my parents, to love my wife, to love my boys. I don't always practice it, but I know what it is like. I similarly have an idea of what it means to love those around me in this church, on the street, as the circle continues to ripple. But after wishing Dzhokhar Tsarnaev dead, I came up short. I came up short against this command to love with agape love, to love one another. And not just any one another, but specifically and unavoidably to love our enemies. What does it mean? What does it mean to love Dzhokhar Tsarnaev? Years ago, this year, in a seminal book entitled Strength to Love, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. offered these words on what it means to love. In loving our enemies, he wrote, "Like is a sentimental and affectionate word. How can we be affectionate toward a person whose avowed aim is to crush our very being and place innumerable stumbling blocks in our path? How can we like a person who is threatening our children and bombing our homes? That is impossible." But Jesus recognized that love is greater than like. When Jesus bids us to love our enemies, he is speaking neither of eros nor philia. He is speaking of agape, understanding and creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. Friends, we know of the terror that was visited upon the children, the parents, the elders in black communities all over this country. And still, Dr. King and thousands upon thousands lived this command to love, even when, especially when, confronted by the depths of inhumanity. And roughly 6 months ago, some of us witnessed a remarkable act of courage in this church, in this very space. Ann Arthur, a member of Trinity Cathedral in Sacramento, was one of a few speakers in a panel about the death penalty. Now, I use the word courage, courageous, and I do so in the manner that sociologist Brené Brown does, with the old French sense of the word, the cœur, to be wholehearted. Because in this holy space, Anne spoke with stunning strength, humility, and compassion about the brutal murder of her son. You see, those who perpetrated that heinous crime against her son, Jim, were apprehended, and Anne and her family faced the awful choice that hundreds of parents across this nation face, whether to pursue the death penalty for the three men who, as part of a botched robbery, murdered her son. After what I can only imagine were excruciating days and nights of wrestling, Anne wrote a letter to the judge, which she shared that night, a portion of which reads as follows. "As the mother of the murder victim, James Arthur, the agony of the crime against my son would be greatly exacerbated by its adjudication as a death penalty case. I base my concern on practical, moral, and religious considerations. I do not doubt the guilt of the accused. Pursuing the death penalty would increase the duration, burden of proof, public attention, and cost of prosecution without, in my view, commensurately increasing the scope of justice served. Further, I believe that the death penalty focus would distract the perpetrators from confronting their actions by concentrating their attention on resisting death. As victims, my family and I would be forced to distort our focus as well. I believe that public safety would be equally well served by life in prison without possibility of parole as by the death penalty. In moral terms, knowledge that justice for my son resulted in 3 additional deaths would be an unfathomable burden for me. The senselessness of the crime against Jim would be magnified and multiplied. While the state of California may be able to carry that load, I would find it crushing. Finally, my faith convinces me to choose, instead of death, to keep open the opportunity for God to work within the lives of the accused, help them recognize their own humanity and inhumanity, and as possible, open them to healing. I have not asked Anne this, but I would believe that there were times when she contemplated the deaths of the 3 men who took her son's life. We may not want to face it, but I believe that there is a space in all of us that harbors vengeance. And when we are confronted by the terror and the anguish and the despair that the void can bring, we are ready to release the hounds of hell. We may call it justice, but often this kind of justice is another name for retribution. And this, my friends, is what I was seeking this past week for the actions of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev: vengeance and retribution. Ann Arthur faced this awful choice. And somehow, even as those who murdered her son laughed, she found strength to somehow love. Friends, I hope that we may never directly face what Ann Arthur has and continues to endure. And yet we are part of the same choice every time a life is taken in our name and we are told that this is a necessity of justice. Friends, there is another way to seek justice, and it involves active, unyielding, unflinching love. It does not pretend that evil is not committed. In its vigilance, it demands accountability. In fact, in its pursuit of restoration, it demands an even greater accountability while the perpetrator still lives. For it refuses to let go of the one who deals in violence and in destruction. It will not let the one who lives by hate take another life, even if it be their own. Again, the words of Dr. King from Strength to Love. To our most bitter opponents, we say, throw us in jail and we will still love you. Bomb our houses and threaten our children and we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. That is how they will know that we are Christians, by our love.